Your North Carolina Reading Service welcomes you to another weekly issue of The Independent. I'm John Fetterson to read this issue, which is dated August the 2nd of 2024. And I would say, oddly enough, but it's not odd if you know me, I have a leftover article from July the 15th about the Durham Bulls, in a way, and I propose to read that to you first. It's Saturday night at the Durham Bulls Athletic Park, and as fans make their way to their seats and raindrops begin falling from the night sky, Chris Ivey opens a secret door behind left field. The door is hidden from view by a pretzel stand. Ivy walks through a dingy corridor behind a giant video board, passing a fog machine that blows steam through the nose of the mechanical bull above. "It's like a cave," he exclaims as water sprinkles in from the ceiling. As Ivy rounds the corner, a hideout comes into view. A long wooden porch sits against the outfield wall about 10 feet above the field, and just below two rows of seemingly boarded-up windows. The porch is littered with more boards, each displaying a white number on a dark green background, poised for the chance to make it on the wall. Ivy, 75 years old, has worked here for the past 17 seasons. He is the man behind the Bulls' manually operated scoreboard. Manual scoreboards are a rarity these days. They appear only in three of the nation's 30 AAA-level parks, including the one in Durham. The most famous manual scoreboards in Boston's Fenway Park and Chicago's Wrigley Field were built in the 1910s. Unlike most modern franchises, the Bulls did not opt for the digital alternative when building DBAP in 1995. Ivy says about this analog version, it's a link to the past. For the purist, it's nice to have a link to the old stuff. When fans look at the scoreboard at the start of a Bulls game, they see a green facade with a neat row of blank squares under labels, representing the teams, innings, runs, hits, and errors. But behind the board, things are a bit more complicated. None of the scoreboard columns are labeled back here, so Ivy counts on his years of experience to determine which is which. The only column immediately identifiable from behind is the wide one to Ivy's far right. A stack of enormous boards with names of visiting teams sits below this wide opening. Fortunately, someone has already hauled the Norfolk board into place at Ivy's request. His experience has earned him a few privileges. Ivy climbs the wooden stairs up to the porch and begins preparations for the game, where the Bulls will take on the Norfolk Tides. He arranges the green placards numbering 0 through 20, each the size of a human torso, and stacks them by group on his platform. The zeros are the most plentiful. There are 22 in total, a testament to the low-scoring nature of baseball. I sit in the ninth inning, he says casually. Answering my confused look, he slides a board from a slot on the wall, revealing his window to the night, overlooking the field. Fans who glance up at the scoreboard may notice a gap under the number 9, representing the ninth inning. That hole in the scoreboard is where Ivy watches the game. He pulls up his chair and invites me to remove the adjacent board and sit in the 10th. The view from our makeshift windows is immaculate. Bulls players warm up just feet away in the outfield grass, and the grandstand behind home plate stands out against the pale blue sky and setting sun. A strong breeze blows towards us. The night's fly balls have a good chance of becoming home runs. Ivy's nook behind the outfield lacks air conditioning, so he places a box fan next to his seat. He pulls out a transistor radio to hear the live broadcast. Ivy has lived in Durham since 1960, the same year the Bulls returned to the city. After a career in social work and decades of cheering for the team, he decided to apply for the scoreboard operator job when it opened in 2008. "I don't know if anybody else applied," he says. "I used to tease the guy who gave me the job. I said, nobody else applied because people either think you're the best job in the world or you're not." Regardless of how he got the job, Ivy is thankful for it. "It's really fun to be this close to all the action and have a role in it." Just then, the Tide's leadoff batter hits a missile in our direction. The ball smashes off the wall like a gunshot, and Ivy gets to work. He grabs a one and makes his way left to the column labeled H for hits. He slides out the zero and inserts a one to record that hit. In the bottom half of that inning, Austin Shenton of the Bulls hits one so hard, we never hear a bang. It sails overhead for a grand slam. Now Ivy's tasks start to pile up. He says, "When you've got bases loaded and then a single, you've got to change the runs and the hits. Then you've got to change the run total for the inning. And before you can do that, they may hit a double, and there's two more runs in." In addition to his radio, Ivy has a small television broadcasting the game. The TV lags a few seconds behind the game, so he uses it to catch up if he misses anything. He says, "Last week they hit a ball, and when the outfielder jumped, his glove came through my window. The television went flying, but the antenna line kept the TV hanging, so it never hit the ground." Ivy keeps his distance from the scoreboard window on fly balls, but always stays close to the fan. The humidity in his cave is starting to settle in. He says, "I'll oftentimes invite a parent and a kid to come back here. Either they think I'm crazy or they think it's unbelievable. But I like numbers, and I like keeping score. And when I'm out here, it's sort of like a zen thing for me." With four home runs already, there's no time for meditation tonight, however. By the end of the sixth inning, the Bulls have six hits and lead the Tides 6-5. Ivy's stack of sixes is getting a little thin. In between the action, Ivy shares anecdotes about baseball celebrities. He used to chat with the Cleveland Guardians manager, Stephen Voit, when he played left field for the Bulls. His mother once dated legendary Yankees pitcher Whitey Ford. His wife saw actress Susan Sarandon at a local park during the filming of the movie Bull Durham. He seems to have a following of his own in the local baseball world. Fans who have joined him behind the scoreboard often ask to return. He gets one such request tonight, communicated via text by the operator of that pretzel stand outside. Samantha Wynn, in addition to serving soft pretzels, serves as a filter for Ivy's many visitors. He turns tonight would-be guest away on account of his current companion. Later he gets another text. His friend just saw him on television. Sure enough, Ivy's TV flashes the manual scoreboard and his white mustache is visible in the ninth inning window. Another home run from Shenton and a grand slam by Cameron Misner put the Bulls up for good. By the time the ninth inning begins, the Bulls are firmly leading 14-5, and Ivy has gotten plenty of steps in for the evening. Bulls reliever Manuel Rodriguez gets a ground out to end the game, and the crowd cheers. The win gives the Bulls a series victory over Norfolk and rewards those fans for sticking it out in the rain. Ivy fetches a zero. The Tide's ninth inning run total brings the placard to the window he's been peering through all night. He slides the board into the remaining empty frame, completing the scoreboard and closing the shades to his hideout. After the team's earlier offensive explosion, fireworks seem almost redundant. Nevertheless, we exit the cave to see the Bulls' Saturday night fireworks show. The rain has stopped, and the fireworks light up the ballpark. Fans marvel at the sight. But it's that view, framed by a cutout in the scoreboard fence, that Ivy comes back for again and again. Come next game, he'll be back in his hideout behind the scoreboard, dodging fly balls, sliding placards into place, and watching the game from his unique perch. And he just might let one of tonight's fans join him. Our next story moves more or less to the area of the theater and playwright Paul Green. This is an interview type of article by Fred Wasser, which went into Indie Week just on the 31st of July. And he writes, Paul Green was a literary giant. A lifelong native of North Carolina, he became a cultural force, a nationally known playwright, fiction writer, essayist, and teacher, who was prominent in the first half of the 20th century. Yet, he's largely forgotten today. A new book of essays, North Carolina Writers, on the Legacy of the State's Most Celebrated Playwright, is co-edited by George Ann Eubanks, Executive Director of the Paul Green Foundation, and Margaret Bauer of East Carolina University. This book explores some reasons for this, with essays by 11 writers, including Marjorie Hudson, Catherine Hunter Williams, Jill McCorkle, and Mike Wiley. Paul Green was born in 1894 in eastern North Carolina's Harnett County. His rise in the literary world was rapid. He received the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 1927 for his Broadway play In Abraham's Bosom, which had a mostly black cast. In 1931, The House of Connolly was chosen as the first production of the experimental group theater. He went on to collaborate with Richard Wright on a Broadway adaptation of the novel Native Son, and received writing credit for all three glitzy Hollywood productions of State Fair. His longest legacy, The Lost Colony, first produced in 1937, is still running today at the Outer Banks every summer. His literary friendships with Zora Neale Hurston, Richard Wright, and Sherwood Anderson, among others, ran deep. A graduate of UNC Chapel Hill, Green continued his career at the state's flagship university, teaching philosophy and the dramatic arts. He died in Chapel Hill in 1981 at the age of 87. Race was Green's central theme and literary through line. His plays are dramatic and engrossing. His fiction, essays, and letters are full of warmth and revelation. He was an advocate for civil rights and prison reform and an outspoken opponent of the death penalty. On the flip side, his writing for the theater now feels out of step. His black characters sometimes seem built on stereotypes. The dialogue in his plays, an attempt to represent the vernacular of the Black South, is often clumsy and cringeworthy. Eubanks, in the preface to the book, says these essays ask hard questions in a present-day context about Green's relevance. Eubanks goes on to state the book is not intended as a comprehensive biography, but as an opening of a conversation about a man who was seen as progressive, even radical in his time, and whose artistic prominence as an American playwright has dimmed in recent decades. In her essay on Green, Catherine Hunter Williams, who is chair of the Department of Dramatic Arts now at UNC Chapel Hill, and a longtime member of Playmakers Repertory Company, struggles with Green's contradictions, as I do. Ahead of the book's August 6th publication, Indy spoke with Hunter Williams by phone about Green's legacy. And here's the phone dialogue. You write in your essay, you would have a hard time bringing a Paul Green play to the stage today? What is it about his plays that doesn't work for you? And Hunter Williams says, I think they're dated, and I think they're limited in scope in terms of the emotional truth of black Americans. I think he wrote from as truthful a place as he could. There may be writers who can adapt them. There may be directors who see something that I don't. There may be actors and actresses who understand those roles. I'm speaking strictly for myself. As an artist, I'm really interested in moving the conversation forward. What was Paul Green trying to do in his stories? I think he was trying to shine a light on humanity. I think he was a humanist, and I think he was trying to foster conversations that were difficult in his day and continue to be difficult today. I would imagine that he probably butted heads with a lot of the conventional thinking. I feel like he was so ahead of his time, and yet he was a man of his time. I'm wondering, asks the interviewer, if good intentions are enough. Shouldn't he have known better? We live in a very different world. I don't know that I agree that he should have known better. I think he was doing the best that he could. I think he did what he thought was right. Paul Green was highlighting social justice issues, but his characters were limited. In your essay, you name three black playwrights, Mary Burrell, Eulalie Spence, Angelina Welt Grimke. I'm sad to say I've never heard of them. You talk about the three of them in your African-American theater class, and you compare their work with that of Green. All three of those women were born in the late 1800s and were contemporaries of Green. How did their writing approach differ from his? Well, they're all products of the style and sentiment of that time period. They were writing from the perspective of being African American. They were writing from the perspective of not only facing discrimination, racism, and violence, but also bringing a voice of the community, truthfully, from experience, into their work, which Paul Green just could not do. I think it's time for someone to write a new full-length biography of Paul Green. There's a lot of source material, a lot of rich material to work with. He functioned and did his type of creative work in the existing culture of racism and cultural narrowness. How he accomplished that is fascinating to me. I do feel like he pushed the boundaries. He challenged people. And maybe this is my idealization of him, but I think if he was here with us today, he would probably be like, okay, y'all, what's happening? How are we moving backward? I think he might also be a little bit like, yay, we're finally starting to have these great conversations. In some ways, we've moved so far forward, writes Hunter Williams. In some ways, we look like we're trying to backpedal. Back to Durham now, and the new occupancy tax law, which Justin Laidlaw writes will support Visitors Bureau and build future projects. At a town hall presentation in April, Susan Amy, CEO of Discover Durham, the city's tourism agency, asked the audience to consider Durham's future. She said, if we grow by the same amount in the next 25 years as we did in the last, Durham is going to be pushing 500,000 residents in our lifetimes. So much of the vibrancy that Durham has had grown up over the last 20 years. So what do we need in the next 20? What's the vision for what comes next? Part of that vision, according to Amy and city officials, includes an indoor-outdoor sports complex, a new convention center, more family-friendly attractions, and expanded greenways and parks. These amenities could be on the horizon, following the state legislature's approval of a new bill this summer that changes how Durham allocates funds it collects through its hotel-motel occupancy tax. The bill also changes how much money goes to Discover Durham, but not everyone agrees that Discover Durham should be the entity that gets such a large portion of those funds, in addition to getting to decide how to allocate them. Unlike property and sales tax, which residents pay, visitors who stay in these hotels and short-term rental properties pay an occupancy tax of 6%, the maximum allowed under state law. Municipalities that collect these taxes can reinvest those revenues to attract more visitors, helping to build the local economy without straining the tax burden on residents. The state established uniform occupancy tax guidelines in 1997. Now, two-thirds of the occupancy tax collected in most cities and counties, that's 4%, has to be used for tourism promotion, and the other third can be used for tourism-related expenditures, things that attract visitors to a community, like capital improvement projects. But Discover Durham, which was formed in the 1980s as the Convention and Visitors Bureau, was created before those guidelines were put in place. Amy tells the Indy, over time, Durham has made some updates and changes to the occupancy tax, but we've never gone through the process of just looking at this tax overall and aligning it with those state guidelines. Until recently, Discover Durham could only use its funds for marketing and promotion, not tourism-related expenditures like a new convention center or sports complex. This, some leaders felt, put the agency and the community at a disadvantage when attracting visitors compared with other municipalities across the state. Amy says, as we look around, we see other communities are using hospitality-generated taxes to build all kinds of things, and that's part of developing attractions or infrastructure and programming. And those things attract more visitors, but they're also things that create quality of life for people who live here. It's adding to the appeal of the community for our residents, and we wanted to be able to do that too. Discover Durham collaborated with the city and county to develop a plan for rolling out the tax adjustments, which needed legislative action at the state level to become law. The agency found a champion in State Senator Mike Woodard, Amy says, who sponsored the bill and advocated for its passing in early July. Woodard says, we've had all these conversations. Susan, on behalf of Discover Durham, city and county officials, administrative officials, the county managers, their budget directors, we all sat down and went through what this is. We worked on it for well over a year. One-third, or 2 percentage points, goes to Discover Durham for tourism marketing and promotion. Half of that tax, or 3 percentage points, is split between the city and the county for their general funds. And that last percentage point first goes to pay off debt for the Durham Performing Arts Center, DPEC. After that, a portion is used to support the Museum of Life and Science. Anything left over goes back to Discover Durham. Under the new bill, Discover Durham will receive a greater portion of those revenues beginning in the next fiscal year, 3% compared to 2% for the city county, and 1% to DPAC and the museum. Then, next fiscal year, 26-7, Discover Durham will receive 4% of tax revenues, while the city, county, and DPAC, 1% each. Finally, in the 27-28 fiscal year, Discover Durham will receive 5%. The city and county will no longer receive any of the funds in DPEC. The museum and Discover Durham will continue to receive 1%. That final rate remains in place until April of 2034. Discover Durham recently published its 20-year Destination Master Plan, a vision for developing the city as a nationally recognized destination. Army said at the town hall event in April, when she presented the plan, "We need a Durham for the future that reflects our community's values and character. An individual might start a restaurant or a bar or a retail shop, but doesn't decide they're going to build a convention, hotel, or major sports facility. So as a community, we have to create that idea together and figure out how to move forward. We need to have a plan for how that's going to be sustainable, economically, socially, and environmentally." Many of the same items were featured in Mayor Leo Williams' State of the City address, suggesting there is alignment between Discover Durham's plan and city initiatives already set forth. But not everyone is in agreement. City Council member Nate Baker says the city, not outside organizations, should be spearheading these efforts. Baker says the Discover Durham plan was inspiring, but it's long-range planning. Baker says doing that kind of planning is the role of city governments and their planning departments, saying, "Where I feel conflicted is I am frustrated that the city, through our planning department, is not being more innovative, and that we are not the ones who are coming out with plans with these kind of projects and inspiring people with our own long-range planning. Instead, we are effectively privatizing that by having an organization that is quasi-governmental." Army says communication and transparency are top of mind for Discover Durham through this process. The agency is launching a new nonprofit to house the work proposed in its master plan this fall. Pardon me. Similar to Discover Durham, the new nonprofit will have oversight from city and county officials and include representation from other community partners. New projects, Army notes, take 10 to 12 years to plan and build, during which time mayors and elected officials turn over and cycle on and off their governing boards. Amy says, "Elected officials, when they come into office, often come in with some of their own priorities, and you have to have continuity of vision when you're going to do big projects that span multiple administrations. Having this as a separate organization will help the community keep their eye on the prize, so to speak, and have this continuity built in for getting some of these projects done." While these long-term projects take form over the next decade, the city and county must continue to prioritize pressing issues like homelessness and education, where funding from municipalities is a key ingredient. Baker says that even the smallest amount of funding adds up, and city leaders will have to find new sources to maintain financial commitments to replace the loss of revenues to the city's general fund. And Baker says, "We debate endlessly, you know, sums of money like $150,000, $10,000, and then all of a sudden, snap of a finger, and millions of dollars are suddenly going to be reallocated from the general fund. We have to make that up." That closes that article, but I can't help remember, Everett Dirksen, Senator Everett Dirksen, who I believe made this quote talking about governmental money, said, $1 billion here, $1 billion there. Pretty soon, you're talking real money." Next, over to Chapel Hill for a serious environmental issue. Lisa Sorg of Inside Climate News shares this article. "No dog parks, no golf, no soccer or football, no child care centers, apartments, or homes, No community gardens unless they are in raised beds. The list of forbidden uses on 10 contaminated acres containing 46,000 tons of coal ash in Chapel Hill is nearly as long as what is allowed. Offices, stores, municipal services, walking trails, transit and parking. As the town of Chapel Hill prepares to redevelop the land at 828 Martin Luther King Boulevard next to the popular Bolin Creek Greenway, less than 2 miles from the University of North Carolina campus, some community members and environmental lawyers say a draft cleanup plan fails to adequately protect the public from arsenic, cobalt, and other toxic metals that were detected in the Greenway in 2013. Homes surround the property, and one is as close as 40 feet. Bolin Creek, which runs near the bottom of the ash mound, is 12 miles upstream of Jordan Lake, a drinking water supply for hundreds of thousands of people in central North Carolina. Under a state-level brownfields agreement, a prospective developer agrees to clean up a contaminated site to levels suitable for the proposed reuse as required by the Department of Environmental Quality. In return, DEQ agrees to limit the environmental liability of that prospective developer, which makes it easier to secure financing for the project. Those responsible for the original contamination are still financially and legally liable. Redevelopment of the site would require removal of some of the ash and grading what remains before capping it with 2 feet of soil along with some eventual paving. Perrin DeJong, Southeast staff attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity, says simply burying the ash under a layer of soil will do nothing to clean up the contamination and address those environmental and public health hazards. High levels of arsenic and radium, both linked to cancer and other serious illnesses, were detected, along with 18 other toxic metals intermingled with soil and ash, according to independent sampling conducted 2 years ago by Duke University scientists. Contractors hired by the town did not test for radium, but they did detect toxic metals on the property, both in shallow and deep soils, well above the legal limits for residential use. Groundwater beneath the coal ash mound is also contaminated, although testing suggests that the plume is not moving off-site. Apartments and homes near the mound are all on a public water system. Like many communities throughout the United States, Chapel Hill officials are confronting the consequences of the nation's dependence on fossil fuels. Continued reliance on these sources drives the effects of climate change, whose price tag is in the trillions of dollars each year, if it is calculable at all. Meanwhile, the local cost of cleaning up old contaminated sites can run in the tens of millions of dollars. Since 2013, when officials in this iconic college town found the ash on the property in preparation for a possible sale, the town spent $900,000 on addressing the contamination, including testing, partial excavation, and engineering, according to town spokesperson Alex Carrasquillo. To remove all the coal ash from Chapel Hill site would run upward of an additional $11 million, capping the material and building a retaining wall more than $4 million, according to town figures. That's equivalent to 2 to 7% of the town's 24-25 budget. These figures are only preliminary and don't include the demolition of the Chapel Hill Police Department headquarters, which is built on top of some of the coal ash. Town officials told us that the cost, quote, will depend on specific plans for the site, which can only come after staff, council, and community weigh options within the terms of a final brownfields agreement. Now, DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, is accepting public comment on the Chapel Hill draft brownfields agreement through July 30th. And guess what, folks? That was 2 days ago. And, however, IndyWeek.com has links to the related documents and instructions on how to comment. With millions of tons of ash produced each year, power plant owners must find a way to dispose of it, either by hauling it away to landfills, keeping it in dry storage on-site, or turning it into structural fill. The American Coal Ash Association estimates that a total of 180 million tons of the material have been used for fill projects throughout the United States since 1980, beneath parking lots, airport runways, and apartment buildings, in bunkers at rifle ranges, and in farm fields. The Chapel Hill ash originated at a UNC steam plant from the 1950s to 70s. Tons of ash were legally dumped into that pit at 828 Martin Luther King Boulevard to serve as fill dirt mixed with construction debris and even household trash. That steam plant still burns coal as well as natural gas. It generates about 10,000 tons of combustion byproducts annually, according to the university's media relations department. Quote, with only a third being coal ash, due to our emissions reduction efforts. The material is then shipped, to Virginia, where it's used as structural fill for reclaiming land at a municipal landfill. Quote, providing a stable base for possible future redevelopment, according to the university. Chapel Hill officials purchased the 828 site, as it's known locally, in 1980 to build the town's police station. That property is one of at least 79 structural fill sites in the state, containing nearly 9 million tons of coal ash. That's likely an undercount. DEQ records only those sites with more than 10,000 cubic yards of ash. And because the department didn't begin tracking the locations until 1994, an untold number of sites have yet to be documented. Extreme weather can expose coal ash in myriad ways. Over time, heat and rain can crack pavement, which has occurred in two commercial parking lots over in Mooresville. Flooding can also destabilize steep slopes of ash and release this material into surface water and groundwater. Of North Carolina's known structural fill sites, roughly half, including 828, lie within a quarter mile of a 100 or 500-year flood plain, according to state data. This means the annual chances of inundation range from 1% to 0.2%. However, as storms intensify because of climate change, many areas that rarely flooded now do so. Nick Torrey, an attorney with Southern Environmental Law Center, which is representing the Friends of Bolin Creek, has this to say. Coal ash is notoriously unstable and prone to sinkholes and collapses. Leaving unstable coal ash in place is too dangerous for Chapel Hill. If officials choose to keep the ash and contaminated dirt in place rather than remove it, the property must be capped with at least 2 feet of clean soil, according to a draft brownfields agreement between the town and state environmental regulators. A retaining wall could also be built to prevent the ash from sliding down steep slopes onto the greenway or into the creek. Groundwater use would be prohibited and the land restrictions would be in perpetuity. By removing, grading, and capping the ash mound, the town could reuse the property, albeit in limited ways. A small forest edges a portion of the ash mound. State officials have recommended that those trees stay intact to prevent the ash from escaping. That has already occurred several times. Over the past 10 years, ash from this mound has wound up along the greenway. In 2016, soil samples in publicly accessible areas showed elevated levels of arsenic, cobalt, and selenium, among other metals, above health-based standards. In 2020, Chapel Hill officials hired contractors to excavate 1,000 tons of the material that had become unstable on that steep slope. Earlier this year, more ash had accumulated at the bottom of the embankment against a silt fence and close to the greenway. That ash was also removed. A chain-link fence has been installed outside of the silt fence. A small sinkhole has already opened on the Chapel Hill property next to the police station parking lot, state records show. Contractors filled it with rocks and covered it with dirt. Tory says, this is not a responsible, safe approach, and it indicates that the town's current agreement and plan to cover the coal ash with dirt will not ensure the public and natural environment are safe. Well, we all know this area and many other areas are flashpoints for rental and housing prices. And here's an article by Chloe Bowl. Rental pricing software could be artificially raising rents for triangle tenants. The software company RealPage, which sets prices for large shares of the rental market in Raleigh and Durham, is the subject of an antitrust investigation by the state attorney general. In a new report, the Triangle chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America says it has found evidence that RealPage is inflating local rent prices. The report comes as Texas-based RealPage, whose software helps landlords set rental prices using a proprietary algorithm, is already under scrutiny nationwide for alleged illegal price fixing. North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein opened an antitrust investigation into the company in March, following in the footsteps of the District of Columbia and Arizona Attorneys General. The U.S. Department of Justice is also preparing a lawsuit against RealPage, according to Politico. In a press release, July 8, the DSA chapter accused RealPage and the landlords who use it of intentionally worsening and profiting off the city's housing affordability crisis by artificially inflating rents in zip codes across the triangle. The press release reads, in their effort to increase profits, landlords' widespread use of RealPage endangers the safety and livelihood of individuals and families across the region by threatening something many take for granted, a safe place to call home. In Durham, the DSA report found that the RealPage median asking rent was consistently higher than the overall median asking rent, between $100 and $700 higher, depending on the zip code. The report further alleges that RealPage is so dominant in local rental markets, setting rents for about 56% of units in Raleigh, 46% in Durham, and high shares of the rental stock in surrounding towns, that the software is effectively, quote, raising prices for everyone. RealPage did not immediately respond to a request for a comment. In past statements to ProPublica and Politico, the company denied any wrongdoing and emphasized that RealPage's rental pricing recommendations are just that, recommendations which landlords can take or leave. However, ProPublica found that as many as 90% of the suggestions are adopted. Stacy Enfinson, a residential real estate appraiser based in Apex, is skeptical of the idea that RealPage could be fixing prices in such a widespread way. Quote, "Our market has so many apartment alternatives, I find it difficult to believe that a software program can dictate rent." Yet, that's exactly what a ProPublica investigation found in 2022 the company was doing in other rental markets around the country. According to ProPublica, RealPage's algorithm uses pricing data from its 31,000-plus clients nationwide to make recommendations to landlord about what rents to charge. Those rents are often higher than what property managers would charge on their own, the investigation found. The DSA found evidence of a similar pattern in the triangle. Nationwide, experts and regulators have sounded alarms over RealPage's use of competing landlords' private data in its algorithm. They say sharing data between competitors in order to set higher rents would amount to illegal collusion. The upcoming lawsuit against RealPage is expected to focus on this allegation. Another component of this antitrust argument hinges on the company's dominance in certain rental markets. For instance, according to ProPublica, 70% of apartments in one Seattle neighborhood were managed by landlords who used RealPage in 2022. In cases like this one, renters have limited choices beyond units priced by RealPage, forcing them in many cases to accept artificially higher rents. According to the Triangle DSA chapter, 60% of the occupied units in Carrboro are managed by a leasing agent who uses RealPage. That figure 63% for Holly Springs and a whopping 96% for Morrisville. In Greensboro, only 6% of occupied units are managed using RealPage. Most Triangle municipalities fall in the 30 to 50% range. The article concludes that the Triangle DSA report used the data from the American Community Survey, an annual census survey that records housing statistics, and from RealPage's own website. And as I mentioned in another connection to another article, IndieWeek.com retains links to their full report for Democratic Socialist Association. Now, my closing real article is called Pay What You Can, Meals on Wheels. Since 2018, the Raleigh nonprofit A Place at the Table has provided Pay What You Wish meal service out of its brick-and-mortar location off West Hargett Street. Starting this October, Table will take to the road with the Travelin' Table food truck. Organization founder Maggie Kane hopes that a food truck is the answer to some of the nonprofit's challenges, saying, "We have been so lucky. How can we touch more people? How can we bring our mission on wheels? How can we do outreach?" Kane says that before the pandemic, about 70% of people paid full price, while 30% paid reduced prices. These days, that ratio has flipped. Kane hopes that the revenue from food truck events, like company parties, weddings, catering opportunities can help maintain and spread the mission of the original restaurant. And Kane says table continues to be pretty full, which is a great problem to have. Since the pandemic, for-profits and nonprofits alike have reconsidered their business models amid changing consumer habits. At Table 2020 put a strain on resources as more people, many out of work, came to rely on its meals. The USDA reports that 44 million Americans are food insecure, which means living in a household where everyone lacks access to enough food for an active and healthy life. North Carolina is the 10th hungriest state in the country. More than 1.2 million people were food insecure in 2021, reports Feeding America. And Kane says hunger is not going away. There continues to be more and more people who are experiencing poverty and who need a meal and a community. We see anywhere from 5 to 10 new people a day, including families. This isn't the first time Table has tried something new. In 2022, the nonprofit organized a food truck rodeo and launched place cards instead of meal tickets, hoping that the credit card-like payment method would be another step towards destigmatizing receiving free meals. Kane acknowledges it is an uphill battle, but still has faith in the community. Earlier this year, Wake County contributed $120,000 to A Place at the Table. Anyone can donate their money or volunteer time to the operation. And Kane says, we have great supporters. I know a lot of other organizations do as well, but the need just continues to increase every year. A lot of folks are struggling, and I think that we just have to, as a community, understand that and really support each other. Support something that is meaningful to you, an organization, or a person that needs support. It doesn't have to be Table. It can be anyone. We have some killer nonprofits in the Triangle. And after a brief pause now, I will pull back to the Indie Week's famed yearly column, Best in the Triangle. And I've held on to the articles from the Durham area, I believe. I'll check. And just start going down the list in the time available, which is about 5 minutes. Grab a pencil if anything interests you. Now, I'm going to be racing through this very, very long article, which consists of a lot of individual places and individual restaurants, in this case, and bars in the Durham County area. And I will just list the name and their category, not their address, phone number, or anything. If you're interested in what you hear, there's a couple ways of rehearing it. You can replay this as a podcast, this particular Indie Week for August the 2nd. You can go to IndieWeek.com, where they have not only Durham County, but they've already had Wake County, and I believe the voting is for finalizing for Orange County is taking place. So I've used up all but 4 minutes, so here I go. So you'll just hear the names of places, just the winners, and it's up to you to find out where they are. Best Alcoholic Cocktails, Alley 26. Best Bagels, well, that's Best Isaac's Bagels. Best Bakery, Google Hup, Artisan Bakery and Restaurant. Barbecue, the original Q Shack. Best Beer Retail, Beer Study. Best Biscuits, Rise. Best Brewery, Pony Saurus Brewing. Best Restaurant for Brunch, Google Hup, Bakery and Restaurant. They won that category as well. Best Burger, Queen Burger. Catering, Alpaca, Peruvian Charcoal Chicken. Best Cheap Eats, Cosmic Cantina. and cheese shop. This is the Durham Co-op Market. How about the best Chinese restaurant? Shanghai restaurant. Coffee shop. Cuckoo Cinnamon. Best desserts. Roses and Noodles, Dumplings and Sweets wins that one. Let's see. Draft Selection Beer Study. We already had that one. Ethnic Grocery Store, Li Ming's Global Mart. Best Food Trucks, Chirba Chirba, Dumpling Truck. Best Indian Restaurant, Viceroy. How about Italian Restaurant? Giocciolina Italian Restaurant. Japanese Restaurant, M Sushi. Best Late Night Meal After 10 p.m., Queenie's. Best Mexican Restaurant, Mezcalito. Neighborhood Bar, The Velvet Hippo Bar and Lounge. The Best New Restaurant, Little Bull. Best Non-Alcoholic Drinks, The Velvet Hippo Bar and Lounge. Pizza, Pizzeria Toro. Seafood, Salt Box Seafood Joint. And Best Small Plates and Tapas Mateo. Southern Food, Lula and Sadie's. Sushi, M Sushi. Best Thai Restaurant, Thai Cafe. Best Vegetarian Eatery, Gursha. G-O-O-R-S-H-A, Gursha. Best Wine List is Luella Wine, Beer and Beverage. The Best Wine Retail Store, Wine Authorities in Durham. And the Best Wings, Heavenly Buffaloes. And those were the Durham County winners for alcohol, cocktails that is, beer, food. And time permitting, in following weeks, I'll still retain, oh, I don't know, 14 more pages of everything from massage to lawyers. All right, folks, I'm going to have to close this issue of Indie. And as I have mentioned before, this program is usually broadcast the first time on a Friday evening or afternoon, and after that it goes into the can, and by that I mean the honorable can. That's the can of past broadcasts. If you need to hear any parts of this again, go to ncreadingservice.org and just look at our program guide. And John Federson will be with you again next week, vocal cords permitting, and we'll have our next weekly issue of the Independent Indie Week. And thank you, everyone, for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Bye-bye.